Good morning. Welcome to Jacob's Well. My name is Mo. Thanks for being here. I want to point out just a few things. First, thank you for participating in that. It was really fun. We had 37 couples who attended our second annual marriage retreat, and we spent the weekend learning about personalities based on the Enneagram personality system and what that means for our individual lives, for our marriages, for our other relationships, and it was really a cool weekend. So if you're married and didn't make it to this one, then know that it's going to become an annual event. So we hope to see you there next January 2015. So another thing going on this weekend that some of you may have noticed is we have a new check-in system in our foyer for our kids. So how many did you parents use that this morning? What do you think? Pretty great? Pretty efficient, pretty fast. So this is a system where parents can go and you log in real quickly and check your kids' names and print off tags for them so everyone knows what class they belong to, who parents they belong to. It just helps with our safety, our security, and also just our efficiency and organization for our kids' community. So parents, thanks for using that. If you have any questions, you can always talk to Nick or the other kids' community staff. And for those of you who haven't had a chance to use it yet because you're not checking kids in, then know that these there are three big monitors out in the foyer here. You'll see them on your way out if you didn't already. We're going to also be using those screens, their touch screens, for sign-ups for institutes, women's and men's events, or youth front camps, stuff like that. And so if you hear us making an announcement and say you can sign up in the foyer, then that's now what those are for. And you can go to these big touch screens and just sign up for whatever events we have coming up, or update your profile, or work set up giving, stuff like that. So note those on your way out, and we'll be using those more as time goes on. So finally, for those of you who ever attend our 5:30 service, maybe you often come to that or have friends or family, please note that a week from today is Super Bowl Sunday, and so we will not be having an evening gathering 1 week from today. So spread the word to your friends and family who go to that gathering. So we have been in a series called A Good Life. Last week, Tim Keel spoke on rest and what it means to actively engage rest in our lives, an intentional way to create space in our hearts and in our minds and in our relationships. And today, Jim Gumm is going to continue in on that series with a message on community. So as we stand in a moment to greet each other, introduce yourself to the people around you and say a little bit about if there's a way that you hope to engage rest in your life more actively this year, today. If you have a plan for that or a way that you want to create more space in your life or a way that you already have since the sermon last week. So share a little bit about that as you stand up. Introduce yourself to one another. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning. How you doing today? Hope you're doing okay. Hey, this morning we are implementing a new check-in thing with kids and stuff, and gives you this little three-letter code. And I remember at a former church I worked at, I had a neighbor who I really wanted to come for years, and they finally came, and they got this code, and the code is kind of, if your kid's acting up, you know, we put it up on the screen so it doesn't say Jim Gumm's kid's a total brat right now, or is screaming, it says, you know, this three-letter code. And she came this first day, and her code happened to be BAD, and it was just a weird coincidence. And then after the first service, Art Gangel came up and he goes, look at this one, and it was H, the number 8 and the letter D, and hated. And I was like, dang, that's just wicked bad. So there's nothing in that. If you got a weird code today, I'm just telling you, it was a strange thing. It's great to be with you today. And the answer is hot tar roofing. Hot tar roofing is the answer to the question that if you were to ask me what was the worst job I ever had, it was hot tar roofing. And I did it in 1981, and I got a job from a gentleman named Boogie, and he got me a job with his commercial roofing company. And I went there the first day, and I kind of was oriented to my job. I got a time card, and I punched the card and clocked in, and then I went out to the yard where all the workers were. And we just kind of dawdled around on the clock, which was awesome, but for about a half hour, 45 minutes. And finally, the job superintendents would come out with their trucks and stuff, and they'd have their jobs for the day. And it was a little bit like choosing teams in grade school. And here I was, this college kid at this commercial roofing place. And I felt like I threw like a girl or something. I mean, I didn't get picked for a while. And eventually, I got I was on a team. I was on a roofing team, and we grabbed the rolls of felt. That's tar paper, but if you're in the business, it's felt. And you get the staples and nails and stuff, and you throw it all in the back of that truck, and then it has a trailer with a little heating device to heat up that hot tar, you know, that god-awful smell that you're just like, what is going on here? Well, I got to work with that every day. And so the first thing we did as part of being part of this new team that I was on is we went to the Quickie Mart, and then one of my coworkers took his wallet out that was chained to his belt, and he bought a quart of chocolate milk and an 8-pack of cinnamon rolls, which was the breakfast of champions. And then we went on from there and kind of drove around and eventually got to our work site. And this was what my job was like all that day. It was basically, hey, you, grab a couple rolls of that felt and then take it up on the roof. Okay, so I grab the rolls of felt, I climb up the ladder and take it up there. Hey, you, grab those mops and you take them up there and put them up on the roof. Okay, I got that. And hey, you, take the gravel and put it in these buckets and take it up to the roof. And that was it all day. Most of the week, hey, you, do this. Hey, you. And I kind of got to knowing that was my name, is hey, you. And about the fourth or fifth day, my job superintendent goes, oh, yeah, anyway, hey, what's your name? And part of me was tempted to just say Aloysius or something. But I said, it's Jim. And the next week, I was on a different crew, and I went out to the yard, and that job had ended. And I remember sitting there for about a half hour, 45 minutes. And this is the only time I've ever done this. I was just realizing, you know, this might not be my tribe. And I walked over to my car, got in it, started up. I drove off, and I never came back again. I mean, I didn't tell anybody I was quit. I just drove away. True. And that sense of, you know, belonging or not belonging. It was this a weird, surreal week of my life with the hot tar crew. It was weird, those guys cooking their lunch on the heater for the tar thing. It was weird listening to Elvira by the Oak Ridge Boys and Louisiana Saturday Night all week long. It was a weird experience. And I think about that in terms of, like, what is it like to belong? What's it like to be a part of a group or not to be a part of a group? And it's a big deal. And so we're in this series called A Good Life. I happen to be fortunate enough to talk about the idea of community. We're basing it on the idea of the rule of Benedict. A couple weeks ago, Tim talked about our life of prayer. Last week, about rest. Next week, Isaac's going to talk about work. But I get to talk about community this week. And community is a little bit of a counterpart to Tim's message on prayer, that what is our life like when we're alone with God? This is, what is our life like with God when we're in community with one another? And I think it's a little bit poignant to talk about this in a day when many people don't necessarily identify with community, or especially a religious community. It's common in our day for people to talk about, you know, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. My experience with God is, you know, I kind of connect with him, I meditate, I walk in the woods. But this is a very deliberate thing, the idea of being together in community as a spiritual practice. Here's what Benedict says in his rule. Let everyone that comes be received as Christ. This highlights this Benedictine value of hospitality. And if you'd ever been part or around a Benedictine community, they have this in spades. And it's a little bit different than how we think about community. If we say someone has a gift of hospitality, you know, we might think they're good at hosting events, or they can put out a great spread, or they make me feel comfortable. And although all those things could be true for the Benedictines, what they're saying is something deeper than that. It's a spiritual view where you're welcoming a person as you welcome the Lord Jesus Christ in their midst. And I believe it goes two ways. I believe that both we welcome that person as they were Christ, and that we practice what Christ would practice with others when we welcome people. There's the Indian concept, the word namaste, where it means this, the part of the living God that lives and breathes in me bows down in reverence before the part of the living God that lives and breathes in you. And I'm in a band, and when my lead guitar player plays an awesome solo. I want to say namaste. That was, oh my gosh, God in me goes, that was awesome to see God's gift in you play that awesome guitar solo. But it's also true when we encounter one another, we're encountering a spiritual thing when we encounter another person. That all of our interactions with people are not just one of hospitality, but a spiritual interaction. That means when I go to the store and I interact in the grocery line with the checkout person, it's a divine encounter. It happens with the people I like, with the people I love, with the people I don't like, with the people that give me a hard time. There's still something in that. Robert Parker in his book says it this way, if Christ is in us, and if Christ is present in the others that we meet, acknowledged or not, then there are no moments in which Christ is not present. Acknowledged or not, there are no moments in our life in which Christ is not present. And often we kind of fall asleep to that truth. We don't live that day-to-day reality that all of our interactions are spiritual interactions, that we're dealing with an expression of God, a soul. We have the promise in the Christian community of this. We have the promise that when we gather together, it's not just us. It's God too. That God too is present. Jesus said it this way, for wherever two or three are gathered in my name, there am I with them. I'm right there in the midst. And sometimes we know that. Sometimes we feel it and experience it and kind of are present to that truth. Other times we fall asleep to it or we're not aware of it. But the truth is that wherever two or three are gathered, there am I in their midst. And so I think the question for us sometimes is we have in our hearts this deep desire for being a part of things, for belonging to a group. There's something that is in our core of how we're made to be that wants that. And that there's also some real challenges to that. There's some difficulty. It sometimes doesn't come easy, and it's absolutely not automatic. I had the opportunity this week to be with the Daniels. And, I got your attention. And I was with the Daniels this week in their home, and they have a little corpus group and stuff. And I asked them this question. It was like, what's hard about being in a group? What's great about being in a group? And the overwhelming thing that was kind of what was difficult is like, you know, we don't live near each other. We don't spend our day-to-day life together. We don't live on the same street and everything. And so you are craving that sense of close-knit community, but we don't experience that in our modern society very much. And so the time that we have together is very precious, but we also have to be really intentional about it. It doesn't happen automatically. It doesn't happen necessarily in our workplace. It doesn't happen in our neighborhood. In fact, sometimes we experience the opposite of community in those places. We experience isolation and alienation. And unfortunately, sometimes we experience that in church as well. And I kind of want to get at what's going on there, what's part of that. I brought this out today. This was something, you can come up, look at it later if you want to. This is the Roanoke Presbyterian Church membership drive of 1960. One of the little treasures of Roanoke Pres that we found in the safe downstairs was this thing on this piece of masonite. And it has some stats and data. But basically what it has is it has a picture of Roanoke Pres and kind of where it is in the map. And there's my house that I grew up in that's just a field and all that stuff. I mean, the outskirts of town is like 95th Street for sure. I mean, that's way out. But it has in here a little concentric circles with a half-mile radius and then a mile radius. And this is what it says. It says that as of December 31st of 1960, that there are 791 members of Roanoke Presbyterian Church. 476 members live within 1 mile of the church, which is 60%. Another 128 members, or another 16%, live within 5 miles beyond that first mile radius. But another curious thing, and that's kind of the idea of membership in those days, is that 88% of people are members and live out of town. But, you know, you could still be a member or on the rolls of membership and not be in town. And when you look at that, they've got little dots there. I guess that's where members actually lived at the church in this time. And when you see that, I'd love to hear from you. What do you think of in light of that for this church 54 years ago? That membership or community or social reality looked like that. What things come to mind? What strikes you about it? It's a walking church. Yeah, this was a walking church. That's why there's a front door right here and two doors on the side. And when you park over there, you have to walk around the whole building to get in. Yeah, what else do you notice? There's a hand over here. Yeah. Yeah. You know, if you're in a walking community, the odds are that you probably went to church with somebody who was a next-door neighbor. And that's unusual for us. We for the most part, there's some walkers here, but there's a lot of drivers. And there's a lot of people that have to be really intentional about this community. And there's some folks who drive a long way to be a part of this community. Any other thoughts looking at that? Reflection. Oh, yeah, Philip. Yeah. Yeah. So it was the whole package, kind of what they're talking about. You know, they lived their lives side by side. They walked to the same grocery store. Their kids went to the same school. They have a different experience. And that is not the modern reality. I've known church communities where they said, wouldn't it be great if we all lived together? And I've known some communities that went and tried to do that, and it really didn't turn out that great. But, it's kind of that utopian ideal. And we have some challenges in that in terms of making our community together. And it's fun for me to imagine 1960 in a Roanoke Presbyterian membership drive, all these men in fedoras with suits, little Don Drapers going door to door, extending the right hand of fellowship with a little brochure about Roanoke Presbyterian and our Sunday school program and encouraging them to be a member of the church. Well, another person who's kind of studied how it is that we connect studied this idea of social spaces. Edward T. Hall in the 60s developed a theory about the relationship between space and culture, and he called it proxemics. I guess it's based on the word proximity, and I guess if you're a professor, you can make up words. But he said how people use space to develop culture and communication and personality. And he identified four main types of space. The first one is this. It's public space. We're in a public space right now. You have come to our public gathering, public worship. And he said not only is it, you know, kind of defined by what the event is like, but it's also a safe distance, 12 feet. 12 feet. If you were new today, I doubt you're sitting right here, close to me. If I was new to a community, I just wanted to check it out, I'd probably go sit up in the balcony. I might not linger at the end of the service. I might just kind of traipse out, and I kind of got to see if it's safe or not. The second type of space is called social space, and that's space that's defined by 4 to 12 feet. That's the space that we might experience in a living room or with a close group of friends or around a table. And that's a different type of space, different type of sharing. A third space is personal space, and this is kind of about 18 inches to 4 feet, maybe a gathering of 2 or 3 people in a circle or face-to-face with another individual where we can read their body language, their facial expressions, their whole thing. And the type of communication we'd have in that space would be very different. And the last type of space is intimate space. It's reserved for just very few people from 0 to 18 inches. There's actually contact. Now, we kind of have some conventions regarding social space and stuff. And so sometimes when those conventions are broken, we feel a little bit of that energy and anxiety. Like if you go into an office building or you get into an elevator with a bunch of people you don't know, you know, there's things you don't do. Like everybody kind of sits there and looks at the door. You don't just like turn and look at somebody. I was at the Royals game in 1995 for opening day, and there was a lot of drinking going on. I was out in GA, where there was way too much drinking going on. And they have those beautiful things that guys have in their bathrooms, these troughs. And the lines were really long. It was about the seventh inning, and there was a guy who just had to go. And he just raced up to the front of the line. He broke all social convention, and his arm was touching me when I was up on stage, and it was terrible, and it broke all social conventions, and things did not happen like they were supposed to happen at that time, because you are not supposed to be touching another individual in that environment. Oh, no. No, no, no. But the funny thing is, you could go to, like, the MLS championship game, and, you know, the shootout, and the guy misses the last goal, and you might hug a total stranger. You might break convention there. All those things might happen. And so of all those different spaces and stuff, you can experience a lot of different types of experiences. We've all had the experience of someone who's a close talker. They broke that 18-inch rule. There's a whole Seinfeld episode about it if you haven't seen it. When I was a school teacher, I learned the power of proximity. I did. And so what I was taught as a school teacher was that if someone was misbehaving in class, don't ever stop your lesson and point them out and go, would you stop talking? Okay, that's the third time I've interrupted you. Would you please stop that back there? No, no, no. You just go back and you just keep teaching. You just keep teaching your lesson as if nothing is wrong. And then you just move very close to them. Like if I was to come over here and let's say Denny was acting up, and I would just start teaching right here next to Denny. And Denny is going to feel this amazing proxemics of me being right here. And then if he was to continue to behave badly, I would just gently put my hand on his shoulder and continue to teach here. And it would really work. It really worked every time, and it helped me to not be upset. And so if I do that during the sermon today, you know what that means, okay? It means you're not paying attention. But all those distances and stuff, all those different spaces kind of define ways that we belong, but they don't guarantee that we'll belong. You could be here in this public space and you could think, I don't know if I feel part of this crowd. You could be in a social space. You might be in a small group and you feel like I'm not connecting. You could be on a hot tar roofing crew in the back of a truck together all day long and go, I don't think this is my tribe. You could even experience that in a very close relationship, where the sharing is just, it's not safe or it's not intimate. We feel that distance. And the way it is sometimes with relationships and belonging, that's especially true of a spiritual community or a church, is that there's something really tender about that space and kind of what we're expecting of it. We will give more grace to bad experiences out there than bad experiences in the Christian community or Christian culture. Here's what I mean by this. I go to movies. You ever see a bad movie? I mean, this is a bad movie. And even though you paid for it, you go, I'm going to leave this movie early. I'm walking out of this because it's not worth my time. I'm not interested. And I leave. And even though we have that experience, we will probably go to the movies again. Or you ever go to a restaurant and it's like half the wait staff quit that day or something, and the cook's gone, it's like they never get there, and it's 45 minutes in between when they show up, and then when the food does arrive, it's cooked wrong, or it's cold, or your order's wrong. I've had that experience, but I still will go out to eat again. But if you have experience in a religious society or a religious group, or a small group, or a youth group, and it's awkward, or you're made to feel uncomfortable, or you're embarrassed, or you're put on the spot, you might not ever come back again. You might not ever come back again. You might think, I've tried that thing. That felt weird. Those people are weird, and I don't want to be part of them. And it's hard sometimes to take that bad experience, especially in a religious or Christian community environment, and to overcome that's difficulty, because there's this challenge to trying to belong and trying to figure out when it's safe and when it's not. How do I get there? How do I not? And there was this concept I learned about 20 years ago about the different types of sharing and how they work in kind of building community. And it's shown through this type of graph right here. Mouth-to-mouth sharing, head-to-head sharing, and heart-to-heart sharing. Now, mouth-to-mouth sharing is not what it sounds like. Mouth-to-mouth sharing is the type of sharing that I'd call chit-chat. It's the type, hey, you think the Royals are going to be any good this year? How could Andrew Luck catch that fumble off the guy's head and take it into the end zone? How could that happen to us again? Weather's pretty nice today. How's your job going? Did you see that movie? All this kind of, you know, kind of light stuff that we do because it's safe. It's chit-chat, and it's really important. It's important to do that type of communicating. Then there's a second type of communicating that we do. It's the world of ideas. What do you think about this? You know, you could leave today and you go, what do you think about what Jim was saying about belonging? Do you agree with it? What did you like about what he said? What did you not like? That type of stuff, that head-to-head sharing. And the last type is the sharing that's heart-to-heart sharing. And this is what we inside, inwardly really crave, but it's hard to get to. The heart-to-heart sharing has to do with passion, has to do with sharing our true self. It involves some vulnerability. It has sharing of regrets, sadness, hopes, dreams. It expresses love and affection. Put yourself out there a little bit. And spreads deep emotion. And the way this chart looks, it's for a reason. It's just not artistic that it's done that way. It's like if over time from left to right, this is the way it should and can develop in community. In other words, you have to start out with mostly head-to-head type sharing. You just do. There's got to be a little testing of the waters to see if it's safe. And then over time, that area of the heart-to-heart sharing can grow, and the need for the chit-chat isn't as great. So here's a mistake we make in Christian culture. Here's a mistake sometimes we make in a Christian community. We're going to go deep right now. Let's go, Nate. Where's unconfessed sin? Tell me. Okay, we don't do that. We can't do that. It's too scary to do. You can't say, hey, we're only going to be deep. Okay, we're going right now. You have this other sense of normatizing what sharing is, what's safe and stuff. And so sometimes we have the other problem sometimes in our group is that we have way too much mouth-to-mouth sharing, or we stay only in the ideas world of our head-to-head, and we don't really talk about what we care about and what's important to us and what's meaningful to make those deep connections. When we have a group time, we take about 45 minutes to just gather, snack, get something to drink. And that's not before the group starts. That is the group. That's part of it. That 45 minutes is that mouth-to-mouth sharing, that chit-chat, that catching up that's absolutely vitally important. And we need that as much as we need the heart-to-heart stuff it sets up. But the good news is if you can get to that point where you develop community, where you develop that safety with one another, here's what is the cool thing that can happen is you can pick up where you left off if you have that type of relationship. Don't you have that type of friend? Don't you have that friend that you could call up today? And even though they live in a different town, you could just catch up to right where you were. Or maybe you only get together every once in a while, but you're there. It's because of the safety of that type of sharing. Here's one of the tricks and one of the problems. We have the problem of, like, our lives are busy. We have to be intentional about a community because we don't live on the same block anymore. We don't shop at the same grocery store. Our kids don't go to the same school. We have to really make it happen. And the second thing is that we have to learn how to create an environment that's safe. Brené Brown, if you haven't watched her TED Talk on the power of vulnerability, you just should. It's just good stuff. 10 million people can't be wrong who've watched it. But she says something that's amazing about vulnerability in relationship, and I think this is one of our biggest barriers. And it says this, when I meet you, vulnerability is the first thing I try to find in you, and the last thing I want to show you in me. You catch what she's saying there? When I meet you, vulnerability is the first thing I try to find in you and the last thing I want to show you in me. There's a longing to know others and be known. And there's an absolute terror of wanting to know others and be known. And what it involves is some element of risk that makes us face things in our life, and sometimes it's shame, sometimes it's regret, sometimes it's comparison or feeling like we don't match up. And I love the way that Parker Palmer talks about what it's like to be deeply connected. And he has this idea that our soul is like a wild animal. Our soul has some elements like a wild animal. Look what he says when he talks about it here. He says, like a wild animal, the soul is tough, resilient, resourceful, savvy, and self-sufficient. It knows how to survive in hard places. I learned about these qualities during my bouts with depression. In that deadly darkness, the faculties I'd always depended on collapsed. My intellect was useless. My emotions were dead. My will was impotent. My ego was shattered. But from time to time, deep in the thickets of my inner wilderness, I could sense the presence of something that knew how to stay alive, even when the rest of me wanted to die. That something was my tough and my tenacious soul. Then he goes on to say this. Yet despite its toughness, the soul is also shy. Just like a wild animal, it seeks safety in the dense underbrush, especially when other people are around. And if we want to see a wild animal, we know that the last thing we should do is go crashing through the woods yelling for it to come out. But if we walk quietly into the woods, sit patiently at the base of a tree, breathe with the earth, and fade into our own surroundings, the wild creature we seek might put in an appearance. We may see it only briefly and only of the corner of our eye, but the sight is a gift we'll always treasure as an end in itself. Community in our culture too often means a group of people who go crashing through the woods together, scaring the soul away. And that's the delicate thing. We desire to know and be known. We desire to have community and closeness. And yet we also have this experience that it's a vulnerable place to be. It's scary. Can I trust you with my soul? Can I trust you with my deepest self? And if I can't, it ain't going to come out, is it? Because it's not safe. If we've ever experienced a community that was too quick to judge or too quick to make a comment that made me feel a little bit less, we might not share again. Philip's here. He was saying something earlier, and Philip and I go way back. We go back 25, 26 years, and Philip had this great, funny line. It was a funny line. He did not mean it, but I remember we were talking about movies years ago, back long time ago, before I had kids. And he would say this line to me. I'd tell about a movie I saw, and he'd say, you saw that movie? Now, he was joking, but it was just a funny line. You remember saying that to me, Philip? Okay. We're going to quiz each other on what movie it was about then. It was an R-rated movie. Like, he was kind of saying, you're a Christian, and you saw that movie? But the truth is that we experience in community, if we say those types of things, you saw that movie? You think that? You did that? That, man, that shuts down community like nothing else. And if we have the experience of someone passing that quick judgment on something, or we realize it's not safe, there ain't going to be any more sharing. There ain't going to be more heart-to-heart. We're going to go head-to-head and probably move towards mouth-to-mouth. It's not going to happen. I kind of asked some folks that I'm in a corpus with kind of some thoughts, and there were lots of great thoughts in terms of what they shared, but here's one thing that somebody said. It said, I don't ever feel like anything I share will shock or freak people out. But I have experienced how it brings people into your circle of life to share and how they are now invested in you, and they want to see healing in you. So sometimes it's the thing that we are most afraid to let others in on that actually we absolutely desperately need to let them in on so that we may experience some healing. You know, another one said about the importance of just being there in that group, the experience of being with others who are not like me. Because if we aren't in a community, we all will fall prey to the false belief that everyone thinks like me and experiences life and encounters other people just like me. And you know what? That is not true. Thank goodness it is not true. And in the community, I experienced that. Friend said this way, Christian community encourages me to sit still for a bit and listen for God and then move instead of just plowing ahead with my own agenda. That the idea of creating a safe place for the soul to show up, for community to flourish, it just doesn't happen without intention. It has that respect for one another. Thomas Merton said it this way, said the beginning of love is to let those we love be perfectly themselves and to not twist them to fit our own image. Otherwise, we love only the reflection of ourselves we find in them. Isn't that profound? That sense of true community is I just show up and all I need to be is me. And that's sufficient. And all that anybody else needs to be in the community is them. And that's sufficient. And the way that God is speaking to them not only informs them, but it informs me. And me speaking about my experience with God not only blesses and heals me, but it heals them as well. That is the beauty of community. That's the beauty of Christ in our midst, kind of working his way. Another person in our group said this way, I wholeheartedly agree that when you bring a community of people together, specifically in a religious setting, of folks that want to be there for the right reasons, the armor that people typically wear, that is people's defenses, and the barriers and pretenses that they usually carry with them disappear because they all crave the same community. That's the unspoken truth. We crave to know and be known. It's that community without judgment, without people trying to be in control, that environment of peace and love and acceptance and patience. That's what the experience of community is. My encouragement today for us is no matter what type of space that you're encountering, that you would get to know that type of community and that it would be deep and worth it. It'd be worth it to you to risk not only the intention of taking some of your valuable time and intentionally meeting with another person, but also begin to go out there a little bit outside where you need to risk and be vulnerable because the payoff is so huge. Frederick Buechner has a great way to talk about this, and he calls it telling secrets. But here's what I believe. Every single one of us has a story. Every one of us has some type of journey or story with God. It's God's writing of his life in you. And part of that story is hurts and regrets and disappointments and failures. But another part of that story is survival and triumphs and healing. And knowing that story, everybody has that unique story, and being able to share it, and I think both articulate it, is part of the healing of that experience in community. In isolation, you don't get the full experience of it. It's the telling of the secrets, the telling of the story, that recognizes what God is at work in your journey. Here's what Buechner said. What we hunger for, perhaps more than anything else, is to be known in our full humanness. And yet that is often just what we also fear more than anything else. It's a paradox, isn't it? We hunger for it and we fear it. It's important to tell at least from time to time the secret of who we truly and fully are, because otherwise we run the risk of losing track of who we truly and fully are, and little by little come to accept instead the highly edited version which we put forth and hope that the world will find it more acceptable than the real thing. It's important to tell our secrets, too, because it makes it easier for other people to tell us a secret or two of their own. I know I've experienced that. That when I'm able to share with someone on a deep level, some interaction, some exchange happens in terms of drawing us close together in community, but I think too in healing. There's an interesting thing I think about telling secrets. If you think about how you tell secrets, I'm not going to tell secrets necessarily in this environment, in a public environment. I don't tell a secret from 12 feet. I tell a secret in a personal or intimate space. And often my voice changes. I kind of whisper. I had this experience yesterday. I was with my wife. We were talking about stuff. We went to the marriage retreat this weekend. It was wonderful. Maureen did a fantastic job of putting it on. And we got to visit some things as married couples do. I don't know if you've ever experienced this, where there's areas that you get stuck about. You know, At least I experienced that. That from time to time, we get stuck about things. And we were dealing with one of these areas that we were getting stuck with. And I was sitting on the sofa, and I was trying to get my act together for today. And Lee came down, and she sat down right next to me. And she said, "There's something I need to tell you that I realized." And she shared with me, in a sense, a secret that gave tremendous insight into why we were stuck in this certain area. That there was something bigger at play. What does that do? That develops closeness and intimacy. It doesn't draw us apart. It's that close relational connection that makes us understand one another in a better way than we've ever understood one another. And we can experience that in a marriage. We can experience that with a close friend. And I think the hope for us is that the idea of whispering almost harkens back to that Garden of Eden type of picture. You imagine the picture of God shaping a man and coming close to that man and breathing the very breath of life into that person. How close you have to be to breathe into the nostrils of a person, the Spirit of God. And I believe in that breath is actually a whisper of truth, a whisper of truth about who that person is, that they are created uniquely, that they are loved, that they are desired, that they're valuable, that they're important. All the things we all desperately need to hear is found in that whisper. And I think in that whisper of the garden, we also get a chance to undo what was done in that garden, and that's where shame entered. Shame that brings about fear and isolation and hiding. And that when we experience that original whispering back together, we can undo some of that shame, where we can be with others in community and we don't experience fear or hiding or shame, that we can be ourselves as we are. That's the promise of telling secrets. That's the promise of the holy whisper. That we can deal with feelings like, gosh, you know, I don't know if I belong. I don't know if I can get past this thing. And we can whisper truth to one another that says, yeah, you belong. And yes, I'm with you. And yes, you will be able to get past this thing. And you're valued and loved. And I dream what we have here at Jacob's Well, that in a sense that we could be a whispering community. We can be a community that whispers truth to one another, that shares with one another the things that really matter, and reaffirms in the same way that God affirms for us who we are and what we're made for. In the world, there's another whispering community, but it whispers different things. It whispers lies. It whispers gossip. It whispers untruth. And we have the opportunity to be a different kind of whispering, a whispering that makes us whole and known and healed. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you that this day we get to gather in this public space And I don't know where we come in today or what we need, but you do. I pray for a couple things. I pray, number one, that you would give us courage to reach out, to be vulnerable, to take the first move, even though we might risk being exposed. Because the hope is that we could know our story as your story, that we could know our story not just as in brokenness, but in also in healing, and that you would make us complete. So, Father, I pray today that we're encouraged, that wherever we are in this journey with this community, that we'd take a step, whatever that might be, with a friend or with a small group of people, that you'd help us to grow closer together, that we'd be a whispering community for your sake. Amen. We have the opportunity today at the end of our gathering, just like we do every week, to go from a public space where 12 feet is the same safe distance to kind of go into a more intimate space where we experience the closeness of someone serving us the Lord's Supper. And we actually experience the closeness of Christ in that, where Christ himself, his body is present and broken, his blood is shed. That's an intimate interaction. And it says that body of Jesus Christ was broken for you, and that blood was shared for you so you may be made whole. And I pray today when you come that that would be an encounter of intimacy, an encounter of belonging. It says in 1 Corinthians, "For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' And in the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes.'" And parents who wish their children to participate in the Lord's Supper, you can go and get them to join you. I also want to remind you that we have gluten-free bread that's closest to the piano. Would the servers come forward? Stand if you're able. Lord, bless you and keep you and make his face to shine upon you. Lord, lift his countenance up to you and give you peace both in this life and in the life to come. And I pray for you today that you would have the courage to reach out, to be connected, to take the risk of being known, not just for the healing of yourself, but for the healing of others and the growth of the community. Pray that you'd have that courage, that peace, and that grace, and you find your place. In your son's name, amen.